Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
We are skipping cons and nons today. Sorry, folks. Because we got to pay tribute to the great Gene Hackman, who was found dead in his home last week at the age of 95 alongside his wife. We don't yet know the cause of his death. Investigators are treating it as a suspicious death. We may not know for a while, if ever, what happened. But we do know for certainty that he was one of the all-time great American actors. He won two Oscars, one for The French Connection, one for Unforgiven. He was nominated for two more. He was the star of arguably the greatest sports movie of all time, Hoosiers, as well as the other movie that Francis Ford Coppola directed in 1974 that was nominated for Best Picture at the 1975 Oscars, The Conversation. He was a top-tier character actor with smaller great turns in Young Frankenstein and Bonnie and Clyde, for which he received one of his other Oscar nominations. He was also a legit A-list star, right? Going toe-to-toe with greats like Tom Cruise in The Firm, Denzel Washington in Crimson Tide, Will Smith in Enemy of the State. There was this really interesting period in the 90s where the hot, young, upcoming actors were like, I want to work across Gene Hackman, and they made it happen. He was the first great comic book supervillain, right? He was Lex Luthor in the Christopher Reeve films. He could do it all. He really could do it all, just shifting seamlessly between drama and comedy, noirs and action movies. He was from an earlier generation of acting star, when a star could just kind of look like a normal guy. Didn't need the chiseled abs or the, you know, classic good looks. He didn't need to resemble a male model. You try and put a guy like Gene Hackman in the leading roles today, and you're going to get laughed out of a room. And yet he could command the screen and the camera with his gravitas. He really was just from a different era. It's pretty crazy. Hackman was nearing the end of his career by the time I started getting into movies, of course, but in the 1990s. But the best thing about watching him in the 1990s and the 2000s was just seeing him bounce off of those greats. Three movies that jump out in this regard. One is The Quick and the Dead, in which he pairs up at various times with Sharon Stone, Russell Crowe, Leonardo DiCaprio, Gary Sinise, Keith David, Lance Henriksen. He just kind of dominates all of them. The second is David Mamet's Heist, in which he goes up against Delroy Lindo, Sam Rockwell, Danny DeVito, and kind of bounces playfully off of all of them before revealing, you know, some real steel underneath. And then there's The Royal Tenenbaums, which is probably his last great film and a movie that has in many ways defined how I watch movies, what I look for in movies. Directed by Wes Anderson, starring Owen Wilson, Ben Stiller, Angelica Houston, Luke Wilson, Danny Glover, Gwyneth Paltrow. Hackman is in this movie, and he is just the best part of all of it, bringing out the best characteristics of all those actors. It's in this movie that he kind of evolves into his final form, that of the disappointing and disappointed patriarch. It's a movie about the way families are kind of messed up but still need each other. And there's just something so perfect about the gruff, grifting raconteur that is Royal Tenenbaum. It's really impossible to imagine anyone else in that role. He just embodies it. I don't know, man. Peter, what was your favorite Gene Hackman movie?
I can't possibly pick
one.
There's
you
no
have to pick one.
There's so many of them. Can I pick a year?
Sure.
I mean, okay, so in that case, I think you can make a good case for 1995 being the essential Gene Hackman year, because not only do you have The Quick and the Dead, you also have Crimson Tide, which is, I think, actually still underrated despite Denzel's ascension to the pantheon. It's arguably just like the best Tony Scott movie, like qua movie. It's just an absolutely perfect kind of 90s original thriller. But then what do you also have that same year? Get Shorty. And he's in all three of those things in the space of 12 months. I don't know exactly how long it took to shoot them, because sometimes these things get sort of shot and then it takes them a while to release, and that's why they're all coming out at the same time. But that's a pretty incredible year for any actor. And just to see him take on all three very different types of movies, three very different characters, and this is late-ish. I mean, he's in some ways in his prime, but also this is a guy who has been working in Hollywood, starring, you know, in films for, been an A-lister or something like an A-lister for well over 20 years at this point, right? To have three movies like that, it's pretty incredible. Like you, I think the essential role for me in many ways is the Royal Tenenbaums. It really colored how I saw him just because it hit at such a formative time in my own life. But, you know, then there's things like when I saw Enemy of the State, I'm not sure I had seen The Conversation yet. Maybe, but I would have been, I don't know, 17 when Enemy of the State came out. I probably had seen The Conversation, but I remember sort of like it took me a little while to sort of directly see the links between those movies, and to have a career where you can draw those links over time, you know, and sort of come back to some of those ideas, and not just play the role once and have it be iconic, but then to sort of to age into something else and see it from a different perspective. It's just pretty incredible in so many ways. He was one of the greats, and it's sad.
Alyssa, there's something to be said for the end of his career. So he's in Welcome to Mooseport in 2004, and he's like, I'm done with acting, and then just goes away, walks off into the sunset, does not come back. And, you know, we'd occasionally get reports out of New Mexico, someone taking a picture with him, he's smiling and happy and, you know, enjoying retired life. And I do think there's something to be said for that instead of, you know, hanging around forever. I'm not saying older actors should all go out and retire right now. I'm just saying, like, it stands out because it is kind of different and unique.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, in a society where, you know, we have these sort of really sad examples of people hanging on past not just sort of the height of their powers, but past the point of competence in some cases. There's something really graceful about saying, I can't do the thing that I was famous for as well as I used to, and I want to end on a dignified note. I want to sort of have another phase of life. You know, and he was a real contributor to the Santa Fe community. I actually heard from one of our letter writers at the Post about, you know, sort of the idea, you know, having him sort of, you know, Hackman bring this sort of, you know, attention and energy to Santa Fe's art scene. He's a big supporter of the Georgia O'Keeffe Foundation. I think he was actually on the board for a while. And, you know, I think it's an excellent reminder, you know, of a point that showed up in some of his later movies as well, that life is long, but it doesn't have to only be about one thing. And that the possibility of change can be there up until the later edges of your career. You know, a movie that hasn't been discussed a lot in his filmography that you didn't bring up here is The Birdcage, in which, you know, he plays a sort of uptight conservative senator who, and The Birdcage is in many ways a movie that feels sort of old-fashioned now, right? Given how far we have come on gay rights, even as we see some signs of, you know, backlash. But, you know, that was one of the movies that was, you know, a sort of important comedy that also just made the point that people love their families and that that love can be, you know, sort of politically and socially transformative. And he's very funny in that movie, which is in some ways an excellent companion to the Royal Tenenbaums. And the Royal, you know, as Royal Tenenbaum, he is sort of a rogue and a scapegrace and a con man. And, you know, as Senator Keeley in The Birdcage, he is, you know, sort of uptight to the point of, you know, just not only embracing hurtful policies, but hurting his family. And that sort of meeting in the middle is his character's changed, and so did he. And that's something that's worth embracing.
Again, it's fascinating to watch his career play out if you just go from, you know, the kind of hard-nosed cop of Popeye Doyle. And that kind of character where he's both hero and villain, really kind of an archetypal anti-hero sort of thing, does play throughout his career. You see it in Crimson Tide, you see it in Royal Tenenbaum himself in a different way, kind of a, but the way his career evolved as he aged was, I think, just one of the, again, as somebody who started watching him in the mid-1990s probably, it was really interesting to go back and watch those early movies and see how he grew and changed, and really think about a different time. Right, Peter? Because, I mean, it's impossible to imagine the era when you had guys like Walter Matthau, Richard Dreyfuss, Gene Hackman, were all genuine A-list stars, big stars, even guys like Donald Sutherland or, I don't know, Elliot Gould, right? Like, there were these, they were like, just kind of normal-looking guys who had real energy on screen that translated in an almost impossible, almost mythical sort of way.
Hey, young Richard Dreyfuss was incredibly handsome, and I'm saying that for our one listener who is maybe a little bit related to him. It's hard to think of a contemporary star who matches his ordinariness, with the maybe exception of someone like Paul Giamatti, who is one of the very few kind of doesn't trade on being handsome types who also is a lead actor, right? Who plays lead roles, can get nominated for best actor type of thing. And he had more charisma, and he could do, and he also had a, he had, I don't know if I want to say a wider range. He was given more opportunity in movies to express a wider range. And so you saw him in kind of dark police dramas that were, that allowed him to give a twisted dignity to a character who was also maybe not so upstanding. But then you also just saw him in like kind of straight up action thriller type movies, not quite to the level of like a Die Hard type something or other, but in the late 1980s where he did No Way Out with Kevin Costner. And then he was in The Package, which is an Andrew Davis film from 1989, which is great. Just kind of not really remembered, but it's this thriller by the guy who would go on to direct Under Siege and The Fugitive, and it's just as good as, I think, maybe not quite as good as The Fugitive, but it's in that zone of just being like a really expertly designed top-notch thriller. And Gene Hackman plays the lead role, and like he's the posters, you know, him in like a leather jacket with a gun, right? It's kind of, it's not, again, it's not quite Rambo. It's definitely not Rambo, and it's definitely, and it's not quite even, you know, Die Hard, which was a kind of everyman's response to Rambo. But like they just let him, they just let him sort of run through all of these different genres. And what you see in all of these films is that often he is playing characters who are either quite flawed or even outright villains, as in Crimson Tide. Whether or not it's in the script, and often it's only lightly or loosely in the script, what Hackman was able to do was give all of his characters this deep everyman dignity, where you didn't root for him, you maybe even rooted against him. There was something really humane about it, and he brought that actorly sensibility of, well, you know, in your own head, everyone thinks they're the hero. And his characters all understood themselves to be kind of the hero, not in a, I'm going to give a speech about why kind of way necessarily, but just in this sort of, they carried themselves like they understood their purpose in life. And I think that's probably because he did, too.
Do we want to talk about the In Memoriam now, or do we want to wait till we're discussing the Oscars in general? Because obviously Gene Hackman gets a nice little spot at the beginning of that, introduced by Morgan Freeman, you know, and then the In Memoriam kicks off. Peter, you were saying that you got hit a little harder this year by some of the names we lost. And I told you that's because we're getting old and death stalks us around every corner.
I think that's right. So look, partly it's because we're getting old and death stalks us, but partly it's something else. No, I'm just looking out the window here of my office, and there's death just actually hanging out like, go away, death.
Get off that horse. Get out of here.
He's in it for the cocktails, Peter.
I make a pretty mean murder Negroni. The thing about it is it's a little bit, it's that you're older and you're closer to your own death, and mortality is more real when you're in your 40s than when you're in your 20s, for sure. But it's also that when you're watching a segment like that in your 40s, after 30 years of being somebody who goes to the movies every week, somewhat dutifully, and sometimes goes to the movies a lot more than once a week, and spends a lot of time watching movies at home, you look at these faces of these people, these actors and directors and writers, and even names I didn't know, but you could see what movies they'd worked on just sort of by the images they showed, you know, and they were craftsmen, you know, producers in some cases, but whatever, costume designers, effects supervisors, whatever it was. And you look and you realize, I have spent 30 years of my life with this person in some way, right? Yes, you hadn't. It's not like I've met them. It's not like I've interviewed them. No, but I have spent 30 years of my life engaging with their work, spending my, like, choosing to spend my time with it. And that's definitely true of Gene Hackman, who I can't remember what the first Gene Hackman movie I would have seen was, but watching that segment was, you know, sort of cause for reflection, also on Morgan Freeman, who is still alive. But all of these people whose work I have just seen, I've spent so many hours with, and you can't have that many hours when you're 19 or when you're 28. And I'm sure it'll hit me even harder when I'm in my 50s than in my 40s, because there will just be more hours piled up of time that I have spent. And I'm so thankful for and so grateful that all of those folks devoted their lives to giving me, to making things that I love, sometimes that I don't love, but even things that I don't love, but to making things that make life more enjoyable, to making movies.
Yeah. Well said. All right, let's move on to the actual Oscars show here, because I do think I'll say, look, this is, in my humble opinion, was a very good Oscars this year. I know it's a silly awards show. I know awards don't really matter. I know that very few people have actually seen most of the movies nominated, but gosh darn it, I think it's a lot of fun. And again, this year was one of the best in recent memory. When you're trying to figure out, you know, whether the show was good or not, you kind of have to break it down into two parts. The first part is the production, right? And that includes the work by the host and the various musical numbers, the In Memoriam segment we just discussed. And I think on that front, the Oscars this year were pretty darn successful. Like, I give Conan O'Brien an A+. For his hosting work, the patron saint of Gen X comedy. He is just, he was on his game last night. He perfectly melded the kind of like off the wall non sequitur bits that he did for Late Night, like for instance a Dune sandworm that played musical instruments, or the repeated jabs at Latvia for some reason, Estonia.
He was great about praising anytime there was like an interesting legitimate first, right? And so Latvia got its first Oscar, and he was like, the joke was, "You're up, Estonia."
Estonia, take that. And then there was, you know, more show-specific fare, right? Like the, you know, the disappointed John Lithgow face, which I kind of wish they had. I wish they had used that for some of these speeches that, you know, went on a little bit. And then in the opening monologue where he kicked Adam Sandler out of the show for wearing workout gear, like between this and his song at SNL 50, it really does feel like we're ready for another Adam Sandler best actor push. I'm going to start that bandwagon right now. I don't even care what he's up in next. What, Happy Gilmore 2? Perfect. Give him the best actor. Anyway, Conan O'Brien was in command of the room. He deployed perfect timing. He kept things moving. He avoided hot-button political issues. I think there was, like, one passing reference to Honora succeeding because it showed someone standing up to the Russians, which is about the closest we got to the Jimmy Kimmel-style clapter in the show, which is good. He got in a killer jab at Drake. I don't understand how Drake has become an absolute punchline over the last year or so here, but it is it kills in every location.
Hey, Alyssa, do you want to completely stop the show so we can explain the Drake-Kendrick Lamar feud to Sonny Bunch?
We're not doing that. We're moving on. But it was a funny moment. Everyone laughed. I was less enamored with the musical numbers. They got rid of the musical performances from the songs this year, but they still had a couple of big showy musical numbers. For instance, there was a Bond montage that kind of melded into a Broadway style big musical performance with stars like Doja Cat, who I know, and then Lisa. Just Lisa. I don't know. Who is this Lisa? I don't know. Does she not have a last name? I don't understand who this is supposed to appeal to. Like, James Bond is like middle-aged dads love James Bond, and that's why you have him on. And the whole Barbara Broccoli retiring thing is like a big deal right now, I guess. So you want to do something there? Fine. But like, maybe have people with two names sing the songs. I don't know. Then there was also The Wiz performance, which I think, Alyssa, you might like The Wiz a little more than I like it.
I don't have strong feelings about The Wiz.
Like, it's a movie. it's a movie that exists. I don't I'm not sure we needed a huge musical number from The Wiz, but we got it. Sure, why not? So the show itself was very good. Again, my quibbles about the musical numbers aside, show itself very good. The winners, then you got to talk about the winners. And on the awards front, I think it was a very solid crop of winners, right? I didn't think Anora was the best movie of the year, but I did think it was the best of the Best Picture nominated movies, right? I was amused and happy to see Quentin Tarantino hand Sean Baker the Best Director trophy, but only because I knew it would drive the craziest people on Twitter even crazier. And there's something about that negative polarization that I just can't get away from. And look, everything went more or less according to plan. All the winners that were predicted more or less won, right? Like Kieran Culkin and Zoe Saldana winning for the supporting awards. Adrian Brody was the front runner for Best Actor. Anora and Sean Baker seemed to have Best Picture and Director locked up. The only thing I was really surprised by, honestly, was Mikey Madison winning Best Actress over Demi Moore. Not that Mikey Madison didn't deserve it necessarily. I think you could make a very strong case for her. She's incredibly good in Anora. That movie only works because she's as good as she is. But I did think that the narrative of Demi Moore as, like, the woman who is, you know, fighting the ageism in Hollywood, et cetera, et cetera, I thought that would carry her to the finish line here. I was very wrong, obviously. In the end, The Substance only took home one trophy for makeup and hairstyling. And really, that is kind of the story of the night, is how spread out the Oscar wins were. Yes, Anora won 5 trophies. The Brutalist won 3. Emilia Perez and Wicked won 2 each. Conclave took Best Adapted Screenplay, nothing else. Dune Part 2 won Most Sound. Very good. It was a solid mix.
Also, no Biggest Worms.
No Runaway Suites. That not an official award. Not an official award.
But it should be.
I like award shows like this. I spread the love around. It's good. I don't want I don't like it when movies win 13 trophies, even when it's something as good as Oppenheimer. You know, I like to spread the love around a little bit. Alyssa, what did you make of the show last night, both on the production side of things and the award side of things?
So first, a note that Adam Sandler has movies in process both with Noah Baumbach and the Safdie brothers. So the Sandman is back, baby.
Baumbach, Safdie, double, maybe two. Maybe he'll get two Best Actor nominations. Don't want to do that, though. It'll split the vote.
That would be incredible. Yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to another movie by the Safdie brothers that, like, basically makes me have an anxiety attack in the theaters. So that'll be awesome. Uncut Gems, definitely a relaxing movie. I thought the Oscars were pretty delightful. And I think part of it was that it was so nice to see a public figure up on stage who just sort of knew how to behave in the environment he was in, right? I mean, this sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but having him be up there and be like, sometimes I'm going to be funny. Sometimes I'm just going to say, like, I really think this director is great. Sometimes I am going to sort of perfectly balance a bit with first responders that, like, lets them be funny, but also just shows my genuine appreciation for the work they did when I had to flee my house. He was a host, right? And I think that for all the talk about, you know, how difficult hosting these award shows is, he reminded people, it's like, hospitality, your goal is to give people a nice evening, right? And it was like, you know, the Carlos Sofia Gascon jokes were, like, probably the meanest jokes of the night, but we're still just, like, well set up.
Also, Hitler yeah. Bad, right?
Yeah, people like seeing someone stand up to a Russian. Like, there were sort of topical jabs, but they were rationed. And there was, you know, there was just sort of an economy to it that I thought was, like, to me, I thought one of the funniest, best executed bits of the night was Ben Stiller ostensibly getting stuck, like, halfway on a riser to present the production design award.
Yeah, like, that was very funny. That was that's a very well-designed bit.
Yes, it's well-designed, but it's simple, right? And just, you know, it did not feel like O'Brien felt like he was either too good to be there or kind of like, okay, like, we're taking ourselves really seriously. Nor did he sort of work himself up into a flop sweat to be like, movies, they're really important, guys, movies. No, he was light. He was funny. He made sure everyone in the room had a good time and everyone watching at home had a good time. And I just feel like we have been, you know, this is isn't even a political statement. We have been missing that kind of ease from so many of our public events of late. Like, I enjoyed it. I was talking about this with some of my colleagues at the Post after, after the Oscars ended. I was like, you know, bashing the Oscars is sort of a ritual, and I don't have anything bad to say. Just as a show, I thought it was pretty delightful. And then they're not really wins that I'm upset about. I will say I thought the wins for Wicked were, there were a certain number of awards that were for like the most costuming, the most set design, the most sound, although really like the most sound, the most worms, those should be permanent categories. And Wicked was very much like the most awards. But man, you know, anytime The Brutalist or Anora won something, I was just really happy. Those are great movies. And I know I felt sort of pessimistic about this as a movie year in some ways, but there's some good movies. They won some awards. That's great. Also, just like, hey, we get to be old. You like grow old watching Mikey Madison be awesome in things. That's going to be real fun.
I liked The Brutalist less than you guys did, but I have no problem with Adrian Brody winning for best performance. I thought that was it really was a striking performance, and he gave the longest speech of all time. Peter, it's a record. He gave the record breaking longest speech, which I, for one, appreciate. I think we need more 6-minute speeches.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just acknowledge that there was one thing I hated a real pain. I think Kieran Culkin's performance in that is like hugely overrated, and I found the whole like, oh, can I not like, can I force you to give me babies now of his acceptance speech. I hated that. I just hated it. That was the one thing I hated.
Pronatalism at the Oscars. You know, we're going to get that birth rate up, folks.
I like I like babies. I think like I think a world where there's more babies is pretty good. But I do think like guilting your wife into having the babies from the Oscar stage is like maybe I'm more of a soft pronatalist than that. But I thought that was weird.
So I guess he's done that before at other awards shows, that this is not just something that he was relating in terms of their private discussions about what happens after the awards shows, but that he has made this whatever. I have no idea how serious it is, because it's hard to tell how serious anyone is, and he, especially Kieran Culkin. But like that he has done this as a bit at other awards shows, and it seemed like he wanted to do it again on the biggest possible stage. I'm not sure I think it was advised. If you think of this as a bit that he sort of recycles and expands upon, then that probably makes it a little bit less, I don't know, awkward or upsetting or offensive or whatever. Like it's less objectionable, I think, that way, because it sort of assumes everybody involved is okay with it at this point, except maybe the viewers.
Yeah, that's maybe more information than I need.
Peter, were you annoyed that there was not more love for Dune on this fine evening of awards season?
So I think my biggest complaint was I really liked Conan O'Brien because I really liked Conan O'Brien, but why couldn't the Sandworm have hosted the awards? I feel like the Sandworm was clearly the star. He paid a lot of money, at least according to one of his like sort of kicker jokes the second time the Sandworm showed up, paid a lot of money for a guy in a Sandworm suit who could play the harp. He wasn't actually playing the harp, special effects folks, but like, why not? Why not have the Sandworm? Why not have Conan O'Brien in the Sandworm suit hosting the Oscars? I think that's the only way that I could have improved the show. That's actually, I have no notes on this. I mean, there's not literally nothing that I would have changed in terms of, do I want every second of this to go exactly like this again? Probably not. I've probably forgotten some of the speeches already. I had to get up a couple of times during the middle of the show because it was longer than The Brutalist. Longer than The Brutalist, longer than Adrian Brody's speech. I think maybe that's my only big complaint here is these things are billed as 3 or 3.5 hours. And they always go closer to 4. They should either accept that it's a 4-hour show or they should not let it be a 3-hour and 47-minute, I think it was, show. One of the two. I understand that it is difficult to play Adrian Brody off stage when he's on a roll and he's got a big win. No, I loved seeing Conan, and for some of the reasons, for many of the reasons that Alyssa outlined, his kind of stately hostness, right? Like his willingness to make everyone feel comfortable and at home, both on stage and through the camera. And he's just really excellent at that. But I also, I love, like, Conan's sense of humor is so perfectly calibrated to an event like this. Also to me personally, right? Like I was not like a big late night talk show guy as a kid, but when I got to college, there were a couple of years where I started, where I like made an effort to stay up late to watch Conan O'Brien. And his is, you know, some of his like comedy podcast stuff that he does now is some of the only kind of non-news, non-political podcast stuff that I listen to at all, though I wouldn't say I am like a regular by any means, just because he has this really delightful sense of kind of juvenile, silly absurdity that he brings to everything. It's just goofy and unapologetically goofy. But then the end, there's always some moment in the goofiest of his shticks in which he twists it, in which he kind of turns to the camera with a twinkle in his eye and lets you know that he gets it, and he gets it in exactly the right way. That he understands, and there's this like sort of shared sense of like, this is ridiculous, but we appreciate it in this case. Or this is ridiculous, and we all know it's actually much worse than that, that he will sometimes like, right? But he like, and he just kind of lets you know without freaking harping on it. It's just letting you know he's actually very smart, but he is choosing to be an idiot for your entertainment because that's the thing he cares about the most, is that like he's not afraid to be silly in any way. And it's just a delight to see that on a stage like this. And yeah, more musical sandworm puppet guy.
So more bits. You want more bits. I hope that he gets, I mean, I'm curious to see what the ratings are, et cetera, but I do hope he gets to come back and do this again because he was very good at it. And I hope they let him even further off the chain, give him a little more leash. Let's get Triumph the Insult Comic Dog up there. Let's get some, you know, in the year 2000. Let's get all
the diaper bear.
Let's get it all up there. He should just do a whole episode of his show for the Oscars, make it a 4-hour episode of Late Night.
Thinking about this like for 10 more seconds here, because I probably should have thought about this before we got on the pod. The one thing I think that was not for me were the musical numbers. The James Bond, the Wicked opening. I appreciate a tribute to Quincy Jones, the greatest pop music producer of all time and just in general an excellent musician. But it's a little weird, actually, right? Even Conan had one song bit, We're Not Gonna Waste Your Time, which was the best song bit because it was funny. But it's a little weird that the way that the Academy has decided to inject pizzazz into their show about movies is to do so essentially with Broadway, and to do so with Broadway musicals. And yes, I get, they're on a stage, they're in front of a live audience. Broadway musicals are the most popular of the kind of Broadway forms, the most, the easiest to translate to television and the part of the theatrical experience or, you know, production that is most devoted to the kind of spectacle that Hollywood wants to sell to kind of normie viewers. At the same time, like, can't they find some more overtly cinematic way to show off cinema rather than trying to translate it through Broadway style singing and dancing? It just is a little odd to me. I'm also not a big fan of that sort of thing personally.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was perhaps an argument for a stunts category, right? Like, do some sort of Cirque du Soleil style stuff that just demonstrates what goes into making these things. Like, I would be really interested to see actual stunt performers at the Oscars and have a sort of circus-like element. I think that would be awesome.
It's time for Scott Adkins to take some punches.
Live stunt show at the, like at Disney World. You have the Indiana Jones stunt show. Just bring that.
I didn't know they did those at Disney when I was a kid and going to the theme parks. They were a Universal thing because it was about showing off the movies, and Universal wanted to show off some of their slightly more adult, you know, PG-13 type movie type things. I remember that. They also had one at Six Flags for Batman. It was the set design was incredible, but the stunts were pretty cheesy.
Well, this is the Oscars. They can do big, flashy stunts. Get Ryan Gosling out there. have him, you know, do some stunts or like ostentatiously tag his stunt guy in. That'd be fun. That would be fun. I don't know. Any parting thoughts on the Oscars? For my money, this is about as good as the show can be, particularly in a year where, frankly, I thought it was kind of a soft year for movies in general, and the nominees were some very good movies, obviously, but none I consider to be like real obvious classics. The show itself was still a lot of fun.
So am I correct? I think I read earlier today that Anora is the least seen Oscar Best Picture nominee of all time. Lowest box office grossing or something like that.
Best Picture winner, probably.
For Best Picture actual winners. And I do wonder what, if anything, that tells us. Maybe that's just a fluke, but we've seen a lot of that over the last 15 years, you know, going back to The Hurt Locker, which was, great movie, to be clear, a movie I really like. But when it had its year at the Oscars, there was a lot of talk about, like, has Hollywood lost its popular touch? And I think we have seen a real divergence between popular Hollywood, which is a lot of superhero movies and animated kids films, and Oscars Hollywood, which is Anora and The Brutalist, both of which I really liked, and both of which are movies that just not many people have seen and not many people will see, even with the inevitable kind of secondary market of VOD, streaming, whatever.
Yeah. Well, Richard Rushfield in his newsletter today noted that, you know, they're of the paths forward for the Oscars, accepting that it's going to be a essentially ritzy version of the Spirits Awards. The Spirit Awards is, you know, that is not the worst outcome possible. But it's also partially driven by the internationalization of the voting body, right? And Matthew Bellany had a similar piece on this, breaking down the numbers of the increased number of voters who simply aren't from Hollywood. They are not part of Hollywood. They're not part of the American commercial film apparatus. They're like indie film directors from, you know, South America, from India, whatever. I am open and sympathetic to the argument that the internationalization of the Oscars is bad because the Oscars should be celebrating American films and American filmmaking, and you know, the whole point of the Oscars is to serve as a trade show for Hollywood. At the same time, you look at the list of highest grossing films and you run down it, and like, I don't know what would you even pick to you know, be a Best Picture nominee, let alone a Best Picture winner. Like, Wicked, I guess. I mean, again, musical's not for me. This is whatever. This is a me problem. Wicked, fine. You put Wicked on there, but then like, What else? How far down the list of highest grossing films from last year do you have to go before you find something that would be a reasonable choice? I'm just going to pull it up right now. Here are the highest grossing films from last year, right? You got Inside Out 2, Deadpool and Wolverine, Wicked, Moana 2, Despicable Me 4, Beetlejuice, Dune Part 2, which, again, I consider kind of a soft nominee anyway, Twisters, Godzilla vs. Kong, Kung Fu Panda 4, Bad Boys, Ride or Die, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, Gladiator 2, Sonic the Hedgehog 3, so many franchises and sequels. It ends with us, which I don't think anybody in Hollywood wants to touch for an award season campaign. You know, The Wild Robot, Venom, The Last Dance. I go all the way down to Civil War at 32 with $68 million would be the first movie on this list that I would pick to be a Best Picture nominee, absent the two that were actually nominated, Dune 2 and Wicked. And I, you know, it's not like $62 or $68 million or whatever the number. $68 million is an enormous amount of money. That's a modest hit. It's not a huge hit. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what to do about this. It seems like maybe the big studios should go back to trying to compete for Oscars.
Alyssa, should the studios make good movies?
Yes.
That do
yes,
well
they
at the
should.
Box office?
They should make good movies. I would be pro that agenda.
Should they make good movies that do well at the box office and also win awards? I don't understand why they're not hitting that button on their desk.
Because they have contempt for you and me and just want to feed all of us, you know, like Marvel slop forever.
I don't know. I just don't hit the good movie button executives. This is ridiculous. You're wasting all of
our
time.
You gotta get one installed on your desk.
Yes, that would be good. But also now, like, which Marvel character is Sean Baker gonna direct a movie about?
Oh, good. I really hope he cashes his blank check for winning the Oscar and does like a Jubilee movie with Mikey Madison. That'd be great. I should not have even said that.
I'm in favor.
I should not have willed this into the world. All right, that's it. That's it for this week's.
Hey, if there's
show.
Any Marvel God, execs,
I'm hitting the eject button.
I've got a treatment for you.
I've gotten rid of the make good movies button. I'm hitting the eject from this episode button. All right. Normally at this point in the outro, I would say many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. But Sebastian has moved on to greener pastures in the Bulwark Empire. We will, of course, miss him. I do not know that he will miss having every movie spoiled for him. Sebastian, thank you for all your hard work. Anyway, many thanks to Rupert Manderstam, who is Sebastian's capable replacement. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.